Welcome to High Energy Health, where together we explore the leading edge of wellness and happiness. I'm your host, Dawson Church. By choosing this time together, you're declaring your commitment to a positive mindset, elevated emotions, and a great life. Thanks for joining me for today's episode. It is such a joy to welcome you here today. I love the fact that you are honoring yourself by tuning into what is positive, what is uplifting, and what can nourish your soul and spirit. It makes such a difference when we make that choice, and we do that when we take it upon ourselves to expose our consciousness to messages of hope, messages of love, messages of peace, messages of joy. And we don't control a lot of what goes on in the world. We don't even control a lot of what goes on in the communities around us. But we do control our thoughts, our feelings. And so that's the place we can create peace, love, and joy for ourselves. I'm so grateful you're doing that for yourself today. My guest today is Valerie Mason John, who is a public speaker and a master trainer in the field of conflict transformation, leadership, and mindfulness. She is the author of several books, including 8-Step Recovery, Using the Buddhist Teachings to Overcome Addiction, and Detox Your Heart, Meditations for Emotional Trauma. She's also been a guest on TEDx Renfrew Collingwood, where she gave a talk entitled, What We Are, What We Think, which outlined a course of action we can take to work on the global epidemic of bullying. And that talk has received 300,000 views. I'm so grateful for that. Welcome, Valerie. Good to have you here.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here with you. Thank you.
And your work and what you are highlighting is so important because it goes back to fundamental issues in human history and human consciousness. And even though you're tackling these big problems from a Buddhist perspective, you are advocating spirituality in the face of enormous global problems. And I so appreciate and respect that. So let's get a little bit of a sense of how you came to spirituality from this initial discoveries you were making.
Yeah, thank you for that question. It's very interesting, actually, that question, because I think, how did I get in touch with spirituality? And I suppose I was aware of something other than this realm as a kid. I grew up in Bernardo Homes. Anybody from England will know of the Dr. Bernardo Homes. And the house parents that I had did the Ouija board. So, you know, as kids, we were just aware. Sometimes, you know, Auntie Hazel, Uncle Tony said, we knew this was what was going to happen because that's what the Ouija board said, you know.
How fun.
Yeah. So, you know, I was astral walking, you know, as a kid, leaving my body. I could read people's minds. I shut that down. I got quite scared of it. And I really shut all of that down. And I think in a way it opened up to spirituality. So I think another place where I got in touch with spirituality, I was incarcerated at the age of 15. Very easy when you grow up in a system, incarcerated for pickpocketing, shoplifting, etc. And I did a lot of solitary confinement. And again, in solitary confinement, I went into altered states. I didn't realize what was happening. But I just knew coming out of incarceration, I was, you know, just for 18 months, 2 years, that I wanted to meditate. There was just this thing that I wanted to meditate. So then again, in the nightclubs, I was a street dancer, wasn't formally taught to dance. And in the nightclubs, without taking alcohol or any drugs, I would go into dhyanic states. I would go into states where there was no self. And this body could do anything because there was no self in the way. So in a way, all of that really pointed to me coming back to my spirituality really in when I was 27, because I worked as an international correspondent covering Aboriginal deaths in custody out in Australia, and I had the privilege to live indigenously with the Yolngu tribe, and that was it. I knew I had, they had something, the dream time. I couldn't appropriate that, but I knew I had to find something. And that was it. When I came back, I just got into meditation and Buddhism, and that's the story for today.
And you've then been bringing that perspective to these kinds of issues. And I just am so awed by the way you have found a way to do that, because we tend to think of these social problems and we put them in one box. We think of spirituality as in another box. And for you to be saying that our spiritual practice actually can be the solution to some of these grave social issues is such a mind-bending concept.
I mean, in a way, I suppose, what do we call spiritual practice? Because, you know, I want to say that people who revere the trees, I mean, I'm really into trees, and that is a spiritual practice. I mean, I sometimes spend time just holding a tree and just feeling its energy. So I think when we say spiritual practice, I don't want us to think, oh, it's got to be Buddhism or Christianity or Hinduism or Judaism or Islam, etc. Spirituality is so much wider than that. I live in a place where I'm an uninvited guest, you know. I'm an uninvited guest in Canada on the Tsleil Waututh Squamish land. And I'm fortunate to be able to work in some of those indigenous communities and actually enter into their mythology and their spirituality. So I think in a way, spirituality is something bigger than us. And, you know, this mundane level, it's not like, you know, wake up, eat, fart, sleep, eat, fart, sleep. And for some people, that's their life. Do you know what I mean? But yeah, it's something bigger than that, that takes us out of the box, that takes us out of the limitation of this mind.
So how can it take us out of the limitations of the kind of cultural imperialism that we are all enslaved by, the horrors of the exploitation of others of the past, the history, the racial history, the inequality we have to deal with that echoes in our world, that those of us who aren't in touch with it, many people are not that in touch with it. Those of us who are in touch with it know it's like an undercurrent in our entire civilization. And it seems inescapable. It seems overwhelming. It seems to be very hard to eradicate. It just keeps on showing up in various ways in our culture. How do we bring, how does our spiritual practice help us with this absolutely enormous issue?
Thank you. It is an enormous issue. And one of the things I come up with is like, well, look at how spirituality has been colonized.
You know, so absolutely.
Let's start there. So in a way, it's, you know, we have to really look at the impact of colonialism, look at the impact of colonization. You know, there's so much about decolonizing, you know, do we decolonize mindfulness? Do we decolonize therapy? Etc. And then we have to actually realize that, you know, even for myself, that actually I have views within me that have been colonized, which shape the way that I walk in the world and shape the way that I think. So it's, you know, in a way, something radical has to happen in terms of dismantling the institutions. You know, we live here in North America, and the institutions that control us have been built on colonialism. So, you know, if we're wanting to dismantle that, we have to dismantle those institutions. And how are we going to dismantle those institutions? You know, I mean, if we think of many of the wars that are happening out there in the world, the root cause of many of these wars is colonialism. You know, if we look at what's happening out on the Gaza Strip, you know, I mean, England has so much, is so much to blame for what is happening out there. Okay. So it's such a big question. And then for myself, when you ask that question, I think, well, what can we learn from those tribes of people who have not been touched by colonialism? Because they do exist. They do exist and they are out there. And these people have the technology, but do they want to share it with us? You know, I think there is a fear, because what has happened is the colonizers have liked our technology, have wanted to take it, steal it, and culturally appropriate it for their own needs, you know? So again, for me, in terms of how can I begin to break out of that, is how can I dismantle the identities that projected onto me and the identities that I cling onto? That is the place that we can begin as an individual. You know, there is the individual and there is the collective. And in a way, how do we impact the collective by actually working on ourselves as an individual? Because we then impact the people that we are connected with. So in answer to your question, for myself, is I really have to look at dismantling identities that have been projected onto me, like black is projected onto me. Which part of me is black? Okay. It's like, I've grown up in this identity that I'm black, and which part of me is black? You've grown up in this identity that you're white. Which part of you is white? You know? So again, it's like, the identities of gender that have been projected onto us. And what, you know, what does it mean to be a man or a woman or a trans person, non-binary? What do these things mean? So I think I really do think that colonization has very much built in polarization, has built in the binary. So even if we began to dismantle the binary, we would be doing something, you know. We look at that, man, woman, rich, poor, ugly, beautiful. Like, you know, we swim in an ocean of binaries. And if we could begin to dismantle that, because, you know, nothing really is binary. It's all non-dual. You know, these non-dual teachings are to help us, if, again, we're not exploring these non-dual teachings through a Western lens, because often when we step into non-dual teachings, it all becomes quite academic. And what is academic about the non-dual, you know? And we know, like, if we just go back to something like gender, we know that in many cultures that actually there was a whole spectrum of gender, which was all part of the gender spectrum, just like there's a whole spectrum of sexuality. So we have to, for me, this is what we have to do. We have to start dismantling the binaries. We have to start dismantling the institutions, and we need to begin with ourselves. And that's really hard, especially when we have been swimming in the ocean of colonization.
Yeah. So I'm going to go ahead and challenge you as you're listening. And as Valerie makes these points, I'm going to ask you to think about this and make some notes yourself. She asked, how can I dismantle the identities that have been projected onto me? And she's saying, start with yourself. So it's tempting to want to go and start with somebody out there. But what is being said here is that we need to start with ourselves. Ramana Maharshi, the great non-dualist teacher of the 1910s, 1920s, 1930s, said, if you want to change the world, change yourself. Who am I? Was his basic non-dual inquiry. He wrote a little booklet called Who Am I? Very short, 19 paragraphs long, but it was all about who am I? And that basic concept is the place, the starting point for all of this. So ask yourself right now, what entities have been projected onto you? And how can you dismantle those in your own consciousness? So it's tempting again to look at our institutions and these big structures in society, but all those structures are the result of the inner structures, and they're a projection of those inner structures we have in our own consciousness. So start by looking at that kind of thinking in your own mind, that either or, that dichotomy that you're seeing here, how have you internalized that dichotomy in your thinking, and how can you challenge it in your thinking? How can you challenge it in your way of seeing yourself, your way of seeing the world, your way of seeing other people, and then your way of seeing your own journey? I can tell you it makes an enormous difference simply to start to ask the question. You may be unsuccessful at finding an answer for a while, but at least if you start asking the question, you're going to start to upset some of these internal structures, which otherwise, if they aren't examined, will perpetuate themselves over and over and over again, generation after generation, and we'll see the same injustices being perpetrated in 100 years and 500 years as were perpetrated 100 years ago and 500 years ago. So we need to challenge this in our own thinking and challenge it all around us. But it begins with noticing it, becoming aware, becoming mindful of these dichotomies, and then really focusing on releasing them.
Thanks for that, Dawson. Yeah. Begins with that question. Yeah.
So what do you recommend people start with when they're on this journey of looking at what has been projected onto them, what they may be unconsciously projecting, their habit of duality? Because it's such a, as you're saying, it's we're fish, it's the sea in which we swim, it's very hard to see the water.
You know, what's really important is that before people even begin to questioning the identities, beginning to let go of some of those identities, they need to come into a healthy relationship of what some of those identities have been. It's like, in a way, it's so easy to say, oh, I'm going to let go of this black self, what's being projected onto me. But actually, how can I come into, come into harmony with it? How can I really begin to love this aspect of myself, you know? And, you know, and that may be, it's like, actually, I don't like defining myself as black, because what does it mean to be black? But at the end of the day, that there has been so much trauma around having this dark skin, that how do I begin to love that? So before we can even begin to let go of some of these things, we have to learn, know what some of these identities are. I mean, there's a 9th century teacher, Dogen, and Dogen would say that to study the Buddha way is to study the self. So that's really important, that we need to get to know what the self is. So to study the Buddha way is to study the self. And then to study the self is to let go of the self. And to let go of the self, we become illuminated by a myriad of things. So it's really important to come into relationship with all these identities and to come to peace. Because so many people have such low self-esteem, so many people are in so much conflict with themselves, that how can you even begin to let go of any of these things? I mean, also, you know, let's just talk about whiteness. You know, for many people now, we're moving in a time where, you know, there are people who are not liking their whiteness because of what it stands for. Because with that whiteness, it means, oh my God, that means that, you know, you have a history. There is a history of what some of your ancestors may have done. And you still have to come into relationship with that and acknowledge also of what some of your ancestors have done. Just as I also have to acknowledge, you know, what some of my ancestors might have done. But coming back to your question, it is critical, it's imperative to come into a compassionate, loving kindness relationship with ourselves. I really do think that if people on this planet, especially in the West, had a more of a loving, kind, compassionate relationship with ourselves, the world would be so different. And we would be even more kinder to the environment, because it's not separate. We're so interconnected. So again, the other thing is that to remember that we're not separate. So I'm not saying that we are one, like this thing, oh, we're all one and whatever, but we're not separate, you know. And that is really important, because when we become separate, also when we're in conflict with ourselves, we become separate, which causes a conflict. When we see ourselves separate from others, separate and other, that causes conflict, it causes disharmony. So again, in answer to your question, it is imperative to cultivate a loving, kind, warm, compassionate relationship with yourself before even letting go of it.
We'll leave it at that and go to a break right now. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back after a short break. Hello and welcome back. It's so good to have you here. And I am so enjoying the dialogue with Valerie Mason-John. I hope you are too. And I hope we're challenging you. My objective actually in having Valerie on was not to make you feel good, but make you feel uncomfortable. And so you'll know that I love asking questions that make us feel uncomfortable. And until we get uncomfortable about some of these issues, we can't get comfortable again at the other end. So some of these issues have been so glossed over, underreported, underacknowledged, that we're at a time in history where we need to be just getting face to face with them and confrontive about them. So I know this may make you feel uncomfortable. We have to go meditate afterwards. We have to tap while we are talking. But I was interviewed by Valerie. And at that time, I realized I had to have Valerie on the show because she is such an articulate spokesperson for some of these issues. She has a new book coming out. It's called First Aid Kit for the Mind. Her website, which I recommend you check out, is valeriemason-john.com. And again, her new book comes out shortly. It's called First Aid Kit for the Mind. I'd like to go back to that early life experience of yours when you were in one of the most traumatic situations imaginable and being incarcerated at an early age as a teenager and having the turmoil you had in your early life. A lot of people, when they have that degree of trauma that early, never emerge. They go into loops of trauma. They develop PTSD. And their subsequent life journey is not a very happy one. Yet you experienced this remarkable phenomenon where you, in the middle of this adversity, were able to find your spiritual identity, enter these altered states. And so I'm intensely curious as to what may have sparked those, what the difference was for you, and what some of those states were that you found yourself in.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to come back to something you said, because I'm actually leading a retreat in a couple of months' time. And I said, I'm going to call this retreat, it's not about feeling good. Yeah.
But it is uncomfortable, you know, it is uncomfortable. People talk about these things. I talk about them to people sometimes and they just squirm, you know. That's an indication of this being a subconscious issue that much of our society doesn't want to face or look at, or let alone actually open your mouth and blurt out what you think when it comes to these issues.
Just coming back to the question, I was just thinking, wow, you know, it's such a long time ago. And I was, you know, sometimes I'm asked, you know, where did I learn to meditate? How did I start learning to meditate? And actually, just tracking back before we get back into the incarceration, that in the orphanage, we wasn't allowed to talk at night. So if you were caught talking at night, you'd get hauled out of your bedroom and you'd have to put your hands on your head and face the wall. And you didn't know how long you were going to be there. So what did you do? Do you resist this? So in a way, I learned to just find peaceful states in this. I think sometimes I didn't care if I got hauled out, because it was an opportunity to find peaceful states, because in the dorms, it was always noisy and people were always up to something. So in a way, I'd already learned to access different states. As I said, I used to astral walk, and I stopped astral walking because one day I couldn't get back in my body. And I was like, oh my God. And then I was back in my body. So coming back to being down in solitary confinement, often when we were put in solitary confinement, you didn't know when you were coming up. You didn't know. So sometimes you get a sentence in 2 weeks, but often you didn't know when you were coming up. And so what did you do with that? And you had no books. And I'd give you the conditions because I read, I think last year, that now they're not going to put people in solitary confinement under the age of 21. I thought, wow, that's me, you know. And solitary confinement, it's, well, in my time was really quite barbaric. And this was for kids. You had a concrete slab to sleep on. Your food was served through a hatch. You'd given a garment that you couldn't tear, you know, so that you didn't hang yourself. And then you were just given a pot to pee in. And if you was lucky, you got to walk around a quad for 10 minutes, if you were lucky. And no, if you were lucky, you got some reading material. In fact, I read Dostoevsky, Crime and Punishment there. I think that was the only book that I had. I read that. And it's like, what? There were people there who lost it. You'd have the same pipes. There were people who'd keep on tapping and people screaming, etc. I just went in. I just went inwards. It was like, what was the point of resisting? You were there. There's nothing you could do unless you hurt yourself. You could throw yourself up against the wall and blah, blah, blah. But I just naturally went inwards and really went into some altered states. Now I know that they were states of dhyana. I didn't know then. At the time, I wasn't aware. And so I think there was a part of me that actually didn't care if I got down the block. I mean, it was so easy to go down the block. I mean, once I got taken down the block because we'd started this trade of the people who worked in the seamstress bit where they were making shorts for prisoners. So we would tell them to make extra so that we could sell them for tobacco or different things like that. And we got busted. So we all got dragged down the block. So, you know, in answer to your question, it was just naturally, when you stop resisting and you accept where you are, you go into presence and there is nothing there that gets in the way. So I just know that I've had the privilege to be able to go back and work as a writer in residence or give talks in prison. And, you know, there are some prisoners who you have life sentences who have done a lot of solitary confinement and you know that they have some kind of insight. You know that. It's just how do you human cope with this? And you cope with it by allowing yourself to be fully present and in acceptance. That's all you can do. Well, it's not all you can do, but that is the best thing you can do. And I don't know why I had the capacity to do that. Maybe because in some of the children's homes I was in, you know, you'd be in the middle of eating your food and then the kids would start throwing tables around, don't want to be here. And you knew that they were the ones who would get sedated. And so I learned to actually, maybe I learned to split then, but to really stay calm. But in solitary confinement, when you didn't know when you were going up, if you got caught or hooked by that, it would have been completely awful. And so it was just like, let's just be here now, you know, let's just be here. And time passes. Time does pass. I mean, this is the thing you realize, you can't stop time, you know. And so you realize that, well, time passes. You don't know when you're going up, but you know time passes. And so really come into acceptance with that if you're able to and you have the capacity to do that. And I do want to say it's not like it didn't have an impact. You know, when I came out of incarceration, I had a disordered eating for many years. I mean, I became a chronic bulimic anorectic for many years. So it definitely did have an impact. And that was stuff that I had to work through. So I'm not sure that answers your question, but what I do want to say is that it doesn't have to be a hell realm incarceration. In fact, when I was there, there were some kids who wanted to be incarcerated because it was safer to be incarcerated than to live in their family home. You know, this is the reality that even for adults, it can be safer to be incarcerated than to be living on the streets. Yeah. At least you know you're going to be fed and you're going to get be clothed. And coming back to in going down the block, which was called going down the block, live away, and you're completely in solitary confinement. The best way to deal with it was to be in acceptance. Just something opens
up. And I'm reminded of the dictum from The Course in Miracles, which says that there are two possibilities of how to respond to any stimulus, and what is love and what is fear. And that seems like a very simplistic view of the world and a really sharp distinction. And yet, when you ask yourself how I will respond, and you find yourself being drawn to the fear, you then can notice that, and constantly interrupt the process if you have enough experience, wisdom, grace to do it, and say, I'm just going to act out of love. And I know for me personally, that challenged so many times in my life where I have good reason to be fearful, and yet I just chose to love irrationally at times. And I just chose love because that was just who I decided to be, not because it necessarily made the most sense or my programming dictated it. But you were able to turn to love when most people were enveloped by fear and may have been swallowed by fear eventually. And I just want to remind everyone listening to us right now that that's one useful distinction to make for yourself when you are in the most challenging of circumstances. And, you know, Viktor Frankl in the concentration camp, or the people who are facing any kind of life-altering problem like that, there's always a way to find a way to move toward that, the love side, and to release the fear. So find that in yourself, find that in your experience, and we'll talk more about this in a moment. You're listening to High Energy Health. Thanks for being here. We'll be right back after a break. Hello and welcome back. It's a pleasure to have you here. Hopefully we're continuing in our efforts to make you uncomfortable and challenge some of your thinking. Valerie has a new book coming out soon called First Aid Kit for the Mind, and her website is valeriemason-john.com. ValerieMason-John.com. What you'll also find on her website is that she's a really multifaceted human being, and that she has a whole bunch of different ways of seeing what she does and her mission and her background. And you'll get exposed to all the different flavors there. And it's really interesting to see how breaking out of the box is possible in so many different ways. So I encourage you to go there. And again, the website is ValerieMason-John.com. So Valerie, some things are just, like you say about solitary confinement for teenagers, are just unacceptable. How do we accept, learn to accept the unacceptable?
Yeah, thank you for asking that question, Dawson, because it's a really important question, because let's say racism is unacceptable. That's my story. It's unacceptable. And I'm not asking people to accept that. Okay, so I think we need to be really clear about this. There are people who are in relationships where there's domestic violence, and I'm not saying that actually one needs to accept that, because actually there are things we can do, and I know that can be really hard, but how can we, you know, when we're in that situation, how can we have the courage to just to do something different? So. And again, so I'm just thinking, like, coming back to being in solitary confinement, what could I do? There's just, in that moment, there's nothing I could do. And so in that acceptance, it's almost just relaxing into this. And I want to use an example. When I was age 27, the holiday from hell, and it was from hell, like, I couldn't get into clubs because I was black and blah, blah, blah. And anyway, to cut story short, somebody tried to date rape me. So they were, you know, kind of trying to strangle me to death and blah, blah, blah. And I was in so much resistance and so much fear. So I wanted you, this fear and love. I was in so much fear. And then there was at one point, I thought, this is like a bad acid trip. And with that saved my life, with a bad acid trip, because I didn't turn to love, but actually I let go of the fear and I relaxed and got through it and was able at the point to be able to get away. So there was some thinking, is that acceptance? It was like this, like the whole body, when you're in fear, you just can't do anything. But there's something about relaxing and relaxing. And I think in the relaxing, there's some acceptance of bringing you into the present, and you have more skills to be able to do something. And I always remember, so lucky, because if you're on a bad acid trip, you don't have to go with it. Those of you who listen, remember those bad acid trips. What did you do? You just had to surrender and just know this is going to come to an end, you know? And so again, it was like, yes, I was able to, something in my body was able to relax. And I was very, very lucky, because it, you know, it happened in a hotel and blah, blah, blah. And I was able to get away. So I think that's really important. That acceptance isn't like we accept the unacceptable, and acceptance is you stay and you suck it up. No, that is not acceptance, that you stay and you suck it up, or you stay and you tolerate it, or what Gabor says, you know, do we go for attachment instead of authenticity? And often we go for attachment rather than being our authentic self. And actually going for the attachment, that's not acceptance. That's an adaptation. And it's so hard to be really authentic in these situations.
Yeah, it is hard to be authentic in those situations. And yet finding some way of coping, finding some story, some perspective that's going to enable you to do it, like your bad acid trip analogy, can make all the difference. And again, it's what, how we hold it in our minds is so critical. And we can make choices about how we hold things in our minds. And then when we do that, we're able to make sense of our story and even make up a story that works for us. I know in my life personally, I've just made up stories sometimes. I say, I will see it this way. I will see it in this positive light, and I will hold it in that perspective. And so that ability of our minds to make sense and make meaning of our stories, and then make a growth meaning, a meaning that supports our well-being, is incredibly powerful.
We can practice acceptance by just practicing the fact that we're aging. You can't change. You know, you can go to the doctors and have your plastic surgery, blah, blah, blah. But actually, the reality is we are aging. That, and if we can come into acceptance, is that we can learn what that is. How can we come into acceptance if we get sick? You know, if we are diagnosed with a terminal illness, what does acceptance look like? You know, so there are places where we can practice learning acceptance. And again, you know, if you have a terminal illness, it doesn't mean to say that you're not doing anything.
Yeah, absolutely. So again, think about those places in your life as we're sharing on this topic where you are resisting, where you're telling yourself old stories that don't make you happy and keep you in suffering. And how can you revise them? What can you say to yourself instead? How can you help yourself shift? How can you revision them in a positive way? It's something you can do, something you can practice, and which puts that event in a whole different perspective. I'm going to take a break right now, but please stay tuned. If you're listening to High Energy Health, we'll be back in a moment. Please do check out the new book coming out shortly, which is called First Aid Kit for the Mind. Also, go to the website valeriemason-john.com. We'll be right back after a break. Welcome back, and I'm so grateful you're here, and you're helping fill your mind with positive messages and personal growth. That's the way to challenge yourself, and that's the way to really shift the way you are and your entire being in the world. I'm going to give you the website of Valerie's new book, and also the title is First Aid Kit for the Mind, and the website is valeriemason-john.com. Valerie, in the last part of our dialogue together, I wonder if you can do something that one of my Black friends did for me many, many years ago, like when I was in college, 50 years ago. He sat me down and explained to me what it's like to be Black. And I know another friend of mine sent me an essay a while ago called How to Be a Young Black Man and Not Get Killed by the Police. And like instruction number one was, if you get pulled over, keep both hands on the steering wheel. Don't have one hand out of sight. I mean, elementary things like that. And most white people have no idea. And when I try and talk to them about these things, they often look very uncomfortable. So I wonder if you'd mind just making everyone uncomfortable and giving us insight.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because as you tell that story, and as I was listening, you were smiling and you laughed, and actually it's not funny, is it, really?
No, not at all.
It's not. And just like, actually, it's just it's really painful to think that actually there has to be the conversation, you know, how just even how to keep yourself going across borders, you know. So I'm not sure what it is that you want me to answer, because I can't tell you what it's like to be a black person. I just, you know, what I can say to you is that if you are in a relationship, there will be white people here who are in relationship with black people in partnerships. And what it means is that actually you lose some of your privilege. You do lose some of your privilege. My partner is white, and she loses some of her privilege being in relationship with me. And I get some of her privilege being in relationship with her. But the world does change, and she gets to see that. And actually, does she protest against it? You know, like, she'll get stopped in the car more now, you know, because I'm beside her. So you're going to have to ask me that question again, because I'm a bit like, I'm not sure what the question is, because I don't want to come from the point, I want to make white people uncomfortable. Because if I come from that lens, I want to make white people uncomfortable, the amygdala goes like this, the amygdala's, and it's like people are closing down. And so that's not a place that I really want to start this conversation around, black-bodied and white-bodied people.
Yeah. So one other way to phrase it is, what do you want white people to know about the black experience that they don't know?
I think just what I want white people to know is, and especially people who say they're on the spiritual path and that they're woke and they're Buddhist practitioners and it's all about letting go of self. What does it mean to let go of white self? What is white self? That's what I want people to know. It's like, actually, do you understand what white self is? And if you do understand white self, are you willing to begin to let go of white self? And what would that mean to let go of that? Because I'm not homogenous, you know, I can't, it's like from an individual, from a personal perspective, what I want to say is it's very hard for black people living in the West at the moment. It's very hard. So let's take the US for a moment. I think it's very hard for parents, all parents at the moment, of sending their children to school, and are their children going to be safe at school? So you have, parents have some knowledge in the body. What's that like? Are my kids going to come home from school? Well, you know, black parents have to double that, not just from school. Are my kids going to come back home safe from, you know, from the shop? And that's always been there. That it's from the colonization, from the enslavement of our people. Are we going to arrive home safe? And so just imagine what that is, how that lives in the body. You know, sometimes white people will say, oh, we're aggressive, black people aggressive, or we're intimidating. No, we're not intimidating. We're not. We've just had to survive. We just have a strong presence because we have had to be able to survive in this hostile world. And if you don't have that strong presence, you're not going to be able to survive in this hostile world. In a way, it's what's really important is that, yes, there are things that we share, but there are many things that we as black people have to deal with, which white people don't even have to think about, you know. So
yeah. And so to begin to break down those dichotomies that we talked about earlier, as you begin to release them, notice when they're there and then challenge them in your own mind. And that's, again, where change starts. So notice just how your thoughts are. Now, it's tempting to perhaps be uncomfortable with some of your thoughts and say, you know, why do I still think that way? Why am I still in this dichotomy? It's okay. Just notice it. Just be mindful of it is the beginning of shifting it. And so just noticing and living a conscious life is part of the awareness we bring to that. And again, just think of the big message here too, is that even the most terrible circumstances, if you have perspective on them, can be overcome and you can thrive. And I think you're one of the most inspirational people in terms of having a very difficult hand to deal with early in life and now thriving. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for sharing with us. And it's been a real joy to connect with you both personally and also in terms of our dialogue. Thank you ever so much.
Thank you so much, Dawson. A pleasure. Thank you.
And thank all of you so much for being here and being open to being challenged, being open to new thoughts, new perspectives. I look forward to seeing you next time round. And till then, love yourself, be happy, and be kind. Every blessing.